Document number 62856, insulation contracting and supply versus S3HG, settled and ready.
Morning, Your Honor. Good afternoon.
Morning, Mr. Ludwig.
Yes. Please, the court. My name is John Ludwig. I'm with the law firm of Gordon and Reese, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant in this case, ICS. And with me today, I have ICS, believe it or not, Armstrong, Karen Strong, and their daughter. And that is ICS, a mom-pop insulation contractor. Mr. Strong's been doing this business for 75 years. I'd like to start off with my NRS 624-626 argument. And if ever there was a case that would exemplify why the legislature in 2005 enacted this bill or this statute, this is it. What we have here is a situation where a contractor directs a subcontractor to supply work outside the agreement scope. The subcontractor complies with the request of the contractor upon assurances that they'll be paid. The subcontractor incurs considerable expense in complying with the contractor's request. The subcontractor later, once his costs are in order, requests a change order. The contractor delays resolution of the issue while costs continue to incur. At the end of the project, the subcontractor demands resolution, but by this time, the subcontractor is on the verge of financial ruin from the extraordinary costs of the additional work. And a bargaining begins. And if we've ever been in this situation before, we know how this bargaining goes. The one who holds the money has the leverage. And it's furthest, and in most of cases also, the same thing happens from the contractor up. In most of these cases, the contractor must procure the additional parts from the owner, and so negotiation begins between them. But as the as we all well know, for the contractor, it's easier to negotiate with someone else's money rather than it is with yours. And that's what happened here. The statute in question 624-626 provides that if within 30 days after the date a written request for change order is submitted by the lower tier subcontractor to the higher tier contractor, and the higher contractor fails to either issue the change order, or if the request for change order is unreasonable, give written notice to the lower request subcontractor of the reasons why the change order is unreasonable.
Wasn't there an indication, and this is a complicated case, it really is. There's a lot of issues to be resolved. And it seemed to be that when there was a request for the payments and contractor came back and it was essentially said, well, we'll pay you when we get paid, and the owner hasn't told us yet. Can you comment on that just a little bit and how this played into that?
I'd like to comment on that because actually the court made findings in that regard. Basically, what the contractor said to the subcontractor is pay if paid. But guess what? They didn't even have an agreement that had a pay if paid clause involved in it. And that's why I'm saying this is a true, the statute must be applied to this situation because there was, in effect, no response. It would be like the subcontractor saying to the contractor, can you pay me this additional amount? And the contractor saying, well, if I win the lottery, I'll pay it. Because the subcontractor...
That the damages that arose from that particular aspect were about $1.2 million.
Exactly.
And this is separate and apart from the other aspects of damages.
Separate and apart from the main contractor they had. What they had is the situation that occurred was the subcontractor, my client, made a proposal for $805,000. There was never a contract issued. Instead, there was a letter of intent issued that basically said, go ahead and start. We got your proposal. Because we got your proposal, we're going to tell you to go ahead and start. However, this letter of intent is only worth 15% of what you've proposed. And what we're going to do by that letter of intent is within 120 days, we're going to issue to you a subcontract. But if we don't issue a subcontract, we can tell you to go down the road, we can pay you a reasonable cost, and we'll pay you your demobilization if that, in fact, occurs in 60 days. But they want, what the court construed in this case was what this, she said that the letter of intent and the proposal formed a contract. But what she didn't consider in forming the contract with those two documents is that language about the 15%. That contract, by its express terms, was only good for 15%. And if they didn't issue a subcontract within that time, within that 120 days, or the 15% of the $805,000, then it would convert to time and material.
But I thought there was also an indication, and I thought it was an ICS's proposal that expressly excluded premium time and shift work.
It did.
Okay.
The proposal, again, remember the proposal's made. It's not accepted. There's no
such thing. But it was taken together, and that's what the court analyzed as part and parcel of the agreement.
The court formed the contract by taking a proposal and a letter of intent, okay? And the way the court construed it was this is a contract for $805,000. But she didn't consider all the terms in it. And those terms are critical, Your Honor, because what could have happened was, again, like I said, ICS could have found, or S3H could have found a better deal and said, hey, guess what? You're gone. I'm not issuing you a subcontract, but I'll pay you what you've incurred today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why should one party have that ability and the other party should be bound to the $805,000? So that language was there. That language was put in the LOI by the contractor, S3H. It was agreed to by both parties as reflected by their signature. And the court found that. Now, back to the 624-626 argument. What happened there was they made the claim for the $1.2 million approximately. And that the response, as you astutely noted, was, well, if I get paid, we'll pay you. I'll send it on to Tishman, who's the owner's construction manager, and we'll let them review it. Well, ICS, my client, doesn't have a contract with Tishman. They have a contract with S3H. And according to the judge, if I take the letter of intent and take the proposal, that contract is with S3H. So, again, it's non-responsive. And they never said, they never disputed the amount submitted. They didn't say, oh, this is outrageous. You guys didn't do this work. This work is, they just said it's presumed unreasonable. That's not a reason. That's not what the statute says they have to do. They have to provide reasons why it's unreasonable. And the reason being is exactly what's happening here. Because if we allow these things to run to the end, and trust me, I've been doing this for a quarter century, what happens is we get to the end, and we have to negotiate. Well, 624-626 was passed for this very reason. It's supposed to bring things to a head then. If the contractor doesn't come back and say, at that point, this is unreasonable, and here's the reasons why. Now, in this case, it's just for extra work. Now, what they could have said, which falls into other arguments, they could have said, oh, are you kidding me? $1.2 million? No, it's your guys. You guys have been sleeping on the job. This is all. They haven't kept track. They didn't say that. S3H didn't say that. In fact, throughout the whole process, they never complained of ICS's performance. Never. Not once. And we'll get to that in more detail.
Well, and S3H, in fact, did compensate for additional work in, I guess, an amount of $500,000 and some dollars.
Yeah, and that was...
At some point. And then there was a request, and this is something that I would also like you to explain. There was a request in early 2010 in the first letter seeking reimbursement for $1 million plus. I can't remember what the amount was. But then shortly thereafter, in April, there was a request for $1.2 million. How did that happen? If they didn't get paid for the $1 million, how did the $1.2 million occur?
Because the costs were kept incurring, Your Honor. So they, well, basically what they did the second time, and if you look in the record, what they did is they added another $1 million something in additional labor costs they had continued to incur because they continued ordering them to keep additional forces on the project.
But they weren't getting paid for the additional work that they were doing.
They weren't getting paid for anything other than what you pointed out.
They kept working.
Right. They did get paid for some things. What I'm going to call the extra work claims. Now, there were extra manpower claims, which is what we're talking about, the 1.2. But there were also extra work claims. And this is very important. Because the extra work claims were documented to the T. If they ask them, oh, tear this out and put this in, the agreement was we're going to photograph it, mm-hmm. we're going to ask somebody who was watching you and keeping time on you, and then they're going to sign your tickets at the end of the day, so that extra work is totally documented.
All right, okay? So that's materials.
Materials, labor, whatever. Now, did they have to add extra forces to do that extra work? Absolutely. But we know what labor was incurred to do that extra work. Now, the reason why the court said, I don't want to accept the modified total cost method in the calculations of damages, is she said, well, you haven't shown me what the additional labor, the additional shifts in premium time was. And she said, you need to show me photographs or documentation of that. But that's impossible to do because you can't take photographs of people doing their, what they're supposed to be doing under the contract. The claim was for additional shifts and additional...
But doesn't that go back to the statute? And this kind of supports your position in the sense that it goes back to the statute that requires the contractor, if they're not going to pay, to tell you why.
Well, it does.
You made a request for payment. Doesn't that put it back on the contractor to say, well, I'm not paying that because of this, this, and this? And that's where you document...
It would have made it a lot easier if it had been addressed when they made this submission. And that's why the legislature says you have 30 days to come back and address this. Okay? If you don't think this is reasonable, say it now. Don't wait till the end of the job. Because what we have then is a mess. I have, you know, a mom-pop contractor that I'm trying to prove their damages, and I have this situation who can't afford, you know, fancy experts at $300, $500 an hour to come in and say, well, according to all these efficiency factors, you know, this looks reasonable. But what I do have in this case is I have their actual costs. I also have documented exactly what they did in extra work. Because it would, to get the extra work paid, they had to do that. So what remained? What it took, the cost for those additional men to perform that extra contract work. It's simple math.
Let me ask you this before you go any further. Do you want to reserve any time?
I did, 5 minutes.
Right, well, we're down to two.
Okay. Well,
I guess. Keep going, that's fine. It's up to you.
But do you have another question?
No.
Okay. The other things, if I could address real quickly, as to the award of attorney's fees. This court in both the Bailey case and the certified case has ruled that unless there's a showing that that the claim, the mechanics claims were unreasonable, had no factual basis in law or fact, an award should not be made to the defendant in this case. In this case, there was two showings that the lien was both reasonable in fact and in law. It was challenged twice by the owner and the contractor, and in both instances, the court found the lien both based and grounded in fact and in law.
Colleagues, do you have any questions on the attorney's aspect? You chewed your rebuttal time down to 1 minute. Do you want to save that?
I'll save that.
Okay. All right, Mr. Schwartz. First thing I want to ask is when they sent the letter and request for payment, why there wasn't, and you're fully aware of the statute, why there wasn't a reason given, and you certainly understand the pay, we pay you if we get paid policy in Nevada, which kind of was indicated in the letter that was sent back from you. When Tishman pays us, we'll pay you. And there were no reasons given. Now, how does that comport with the statute?
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that that is not a completely accurate account of the responsive letter, which I actually have in front of me.
Okay, if you'd read that for us and into the record, we'd appreciate it.
Sure. Please consider this to be our company's statutory response to your change order request, request for contract modification dated 1-19-10. There was a subsequent one, the same effect.
Sure.
We have forwarded your COR to Tishman Construction Company of Nevada for consideration and response. As you are aware, our obligation to approve a given COR is contingent upon our receipt of approval and payment for such from Tishman Construction Company of Nevada. As a result, until such time as Tishman Construction Company of Nevada performs a comprehensive review and responds to the propriety of the COR, we must assume and conclude that COR is unreasonable under the circumstance. We must therefore reject your request.
Counsel, isn't this, though, as was stated, the contract is not with the party you just so stated. This contract is with S3H.
I understand that, Your Honor. What I submit to Your Honor is that...
And so we then come back to the reasonableness of the statement, because your company that you are defending has the obligation to say why they are not doing it based upon their agreement, not their supplemental agreement with the primary contractor.
Because the practical realities of the situation are that we have a lower-tiered sub making a request for a change order to a higher-tiered sub who is not going to be able to get approve a change order request.
Are you disputing that?
The letter of no documentation.
Counsel, is your client disputing that the work was asked for? That they put on extra manpower, work holidays, and so on?
Nobody's disputing, and I think the trial record is entirely clear, nobody's disputing that there was additional work performed. But the problem we end up with, Your Honor, is there was a substantial amount of payment made, and as the trial court recognized, there was no way possible under the theory of damages advanced by ICS at trial to conclude that the additional approximately $800,000 that ICS got paid on top of its base contract price didn't fully compensate it for the additional work performed. That was the problem. At the end of the day, this argument about 626 is much ado about nothing in that they still have to prove their damages, and they came nowhere close. They came nowhere close. There's nothing in the record from the trial, and there's nothing in post-trial or in this appeal where they made any effort to explain why they came anywhere close to proving damages. The conclusion that it was impossible for them to take all of the mountain of pictures that had been done and match it up with purported extra work that they didn't get paid for as opposed to the extra work they did get paid for, double the amount of their contract price by the end of the day. That just doesn't hold water, Your Honor. The real problem for them is there was ample documentation of the work that was done, and none of it matched up. You had OSIP reports, you had weekly reports, and you had individual employee time reports, and you had pictures. And when you tried to put them all together, you could not in any way figure out how they were entitled to payment beyond what they had received. Now, the really important issue that I think has not been addressed here yet is the waiver.
And is that a statutorily correct waiver?
Well, The trial court concluded that it was.
I understand that, but I asked you the question.
Yes, it was.
Based upon the law.
Yes, it was a statutorily correct waiver.
Because we're
the incident. $601,000 paid?
There was never an agreement for payment of $601,000.
What was the agreement for?
There was no agreement. Judge Gonzalez, up until...
So if there was no agreement, do we in fact have a waiver?
Yes. You have a waiver effectuated by the tender
you
of...
You said there's no meeting of the minds as to what was due and owing.
You don't.
So how do you get to an agreement if you're telling me the parties didn't agree?
If you want to know what the terms of the agreement are, you look at the unconditional waiver and release that was executed and delivered and the exchange of payments in the amount set forth in the document.
And there's a dispute as to whether or not that's valid pursuant to Nevada law, as it was done in this case.
There's a finding by the district court that the unconditional waiver was tendered. There is a finding by the district court, and that finding is not challenged on this appeal. ICS does not challenge the finding of the district court that there was a tender. The overwhelming evidence demonstrates there had to have been a tender. They would not have gotten their checks if there hadn't been a tender. There wouldn't have been a release of retention by the higher-tiered contractor if there hadn't been a tender of an unconditional. What's happening here is they came back after the fact, months after the fact, and decided that there was a oral settlement that's nowhere reflected in a document. There's no correspondence after this saying, wait, that wasn't our deal. They got the checks in the amount that was set forth in the unconditional waivers that they tendered, took their money, and then decided a few months later, you know what, we're going to come back and ask for another $1 million. You have to be able to put this issue to rest if you're the middle-tiered sub. You go to and work out a deal. You give them the money that's set forth in the waivers they give you, and you're done, and you move on. You can't then have them come out of the woodwork months later and say, well, we'd actually like to say that the deal was different. The $600,000 number isn't even right. It isn't even right because there was a double counting of a retention payment that was owed. That was explained at trial. If you have an unconditional waiver, it's over. The statute makes it abundantly clear that even if there's not payment, once you've delivered it, your right to a claim or a lien on that is over. Now, there's another issue, and we haven't talked about this yet, but it's very extensively briefed, which is there's clearly been an award of damages, which has to have been an award of damages on a contract claim. Not on a lien, it has to have been awarded contract damages because it wasn't in the lien. If you look at the document that was submitted at trial to substantiate the approximately $51,000 in damages or supposedly unpaid time and material tickets, it says on the top of that specific document, it was for matters that weren't invoiced, and the date of the document is over a year after the mechanics lien was recorded. It came up for the first time right on the eve of trial. Now, it wasn't subsumed within the lien. It was a damages award on contract. When you go back and actually look at Plaintiff's Trial Exhibit 26, ICS's trial exhibit, and you compare it to the amounts in that summary report, it is abundantly clear that over $36,000 of those time and material tickets were paid through change order number one. And there's been a finding, and there's no dispute, that 100% of the change order requests were paid. So you have a double award of contract damages. It's important that we understand that regardless of how the district court mischaracterized those as a lienable amount and being awarded pursuant to the lien, they could not have been. They were awarded pursuant to contract. If the only damages that were awarded, over-awarded, were awarded pursuant to contract, there is no statutory basis under NRS 108-237 for ICS to seek and recover attorney's fees. In fact, the only party that would be entitled to recover attorney's fees at that point, since there's been no amount awarded on the claim for foreclosure on mechanics lien, would be S3H. There's also a problem here, as we talked about in our briefs, that there was an award of contract damages. There's a double award if you actually properly adjust the amount to the $14,000 that wasn't paid. The $14,000, we are significantly under the offer of judgment we made before trial. The offer of judgment that was made in June of 2011.
That was for $50,000.
It was for $50,000. And as you factor in the pre-offer costs that had actually been incurred, the pre-offer attorney's fees, when you do an apples-to-apples analysis, at that time, their claim was worth about $22,000. At the end of the day, all of the positions that are advanced by ICS lead us to the same stopping point, which is they still needed to go to the district court and prove up their damages on all of their claims, apart from the unjust enrichment claim, which that shouldn't have made it to trial at that point. There's absolutely no legal basis for an unjust enrichment claim against a middle-tier sub. But on the other two claims, for breach of contract or foreclosure on the mechanics lien, you still have to prove up your damages. They came nowhere close. And they can't stand here and tell you
isn't that the reason you've got 624, 626, and 624, 610? You know, you have an opportunity as a middle-tiered sub or a higher-tiered sub to object and ask for more time or give a reason why the request for the change order is unreasonable.
And you, Darren, I'm glad that you brought up 624, 610, because obviously that's not something that has been advanced by ICS. But it's interesting because 624, 610 creates a much different and higher burden for an owner in its relationship with the GC than 624, 626 does for middle-tiered subs and lower-tiered subs.
And in looking, assuming that's the case and assuming it is potentially ambiguous in that regard, isn't it what the legislature intended was the burden goes on you to provide a reason for the request being unreasonable or else pay it?
And I submit to your honors that telling your sub, and I think it's important to note, they sent two of these notices, we sent the response back. There was never a, hey, this isn't a good enough response. We understand that these are forms that are generated by counsel for the parties. They submit them to each other. They get the response back, and they say, hey, the statute says this isn't good enough. No, they didn't say anything. They said nothing in response to, what are we supposed to do with this? What does this mean?
But does the statute that applies to you as a middle-tier sub allow you additional time for investigation?
Not expressly, I think.
No, you'd have to look to 610 as a higher-tier sub.
It contains a minimal requirement that we respond and say, we're rejecting it. Here's the reason. And the reason in this case was, we can't at this point tell you that it's going to be approved.
Which means I need more time.
What's that?
Which means I need more time.
Right, which is why they submitted another request exactly the same, essentially, several months later. And the response was the same.
I need more time. But do you have the privilege to ask for more time under the statute?
I don't think that it's expressed under the statute, no.
And so if you take 610, 626, you'd say you'd have to read those together and say you do have more time.
Well, I think that you have to read them together, but recognizing that if one has more requirements than the other, then you should assume that was for a particular reason. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time to the little that I have at this point.
He's got a cross appeal, yeah. Sure.
Thank you.
Okay.
One more minute, so I'll be very brief, Your Honor. First of all, 624, 626, Section 3 doesn't require proof. It required at all. It says, if a higher tier contractor fails to issue a change order or fails to give written notice pursuant to paragraph E of Section 1, which would require a reason why the change order is unreasonable, a reason based in the contract, one would assume, which they didn't give in this case. It says the lower tier subcontractor may submit to the contractor a billing or invoice for labor, materials, equipment, or services
that are subject to the request for change order, and D, the higher tier contractor shall pay the lower tier contractor for such labor, material, equipment, or services with the next payment. So, if you submit a change order under 626 and it is not responded to in accordance with the statute, i.e. giving reasons, legitimate reasons, not like if I win the lottery or if somebody else pays me for that, because you don't have that obligation in your subcontract, then you have to pay the amount requested. That's what the statute says.
Do you read their response, the middle tier subcontractor, do you read their response as requesting more time to investigate?
No, I read their response as just a delay tactic. They knew they didn't have a pay of pay clause with my client, and yet they said, basically, well, if we get paid, we'll pay you. Well, that condition isn't in any form of agreement. It's not in form of what the court found the agreement to be. And this pays a disfavor in Nevada. So how can that be a legitimate answer? An illegal answer that's not even in the contract.
Is it your position you didn't need to prove up your damages at that time?
Not according to Section 3 of 626.
Just make the request for the change order. They either give you reasons for rejecting it, or they pay it.
Right. And what's obvious here is they understood this statute. They responded saying, this is our response in accordance with this statute. But they didn't give us a response. They didn't look at their agreement. They didn't say, hey, this is all your stuff.
So you're looking for us to say, as a matter of law, this is an inadequate response.
Exactly. Enforce the statute. That's what needs to be done. The contractors all know it's out there. Now enforce it. Say, if you don't respond within 30 days, according to the statute, you're going to pay the change order. Period. I guarantee you, we won't have this going to the end, which the legislature wanted to stop. We won't have that. That's what they wrote in their statute. It should be enforced. And if AGC or somebody says that's too extreme, they can go back up to the legislature and have them rewrite the statute. But right now it says, if I submit a change order and you don't respond in 30 days, you pay the change order. You don't have to prove it. You just pay it.
You know, and that just brings up another question for me. You know, when you've got, when you're requesting $1.2 million in change order requests, how within 30 days is the middle tiered subcontractor supposed to determine whether or not that's reasonable without, you know, as part of your request, submitting? This is what we've done. And to me it seems an impossible burden to overcome.
I think you could give a legitimate answer. You could say, you know, you're documenting all the extra work. You could say, you know, we believe that this work is caused by your failure to work in an efficient manner. That would be sufficient.
But how are they supposed to know unless you provide something along with your letter?
We did. We provided, you'll see in the record, we provided, well, for 26. This is the cost records where every date that every employee worked.
Okay.
In addition, we also showed them, we gave them the summary of the extra work that they had ordered us to do, that they took
within 30 days, they're supposed to take all that information and make a determination as to whether or not it was reasonable or unreasonable.
In 30 days, they should come with some legitimate response. If they looked at this, I guarantee you within 30 days you could look at this, and if your on-site supervisor said, you know what, I caught 10 guys in the bathroom there for 8 hours, or I did this. You can come back. You don't need to be precise, but you can say, we have done our investigation. We believe that this is outrageous because our field supervisors are saying that your people aren't working on the job.
Right.
We've done counts. You know, I get this. I could go out and send my field people out there to do a count the next day to see how many people are out there. And if it was illegitimate, I could write back and say, you know what, we've tested this out.
Yeah.
You don't have these people out there.
Okay. Counsel, thank you for your argument.
Thank you so much for your consideration.
All right. Counsel, you got about 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honors. There's one point that I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, and it addresses, in part, the reason for including a discussion of why Tishman's important in responding to the change order request in this case. And that is, it is in the findings. It was a factual point that was made earlier in this hearing by counsel. Some of the work, the additional work that was being completed, was directly requested from above S3H's level. It was coming directly from Tishman. That's been a finding in the record by the court. Therefore, when the work is being requested from Tishman, it is important that if there's a change order request, that it also be cleared with Tishman. So that's a point that has
to
be.
Do you know the how much did that account for?
No idea, because I have no idea what they're claiming. At this point, I still have no idea. The problem is, he talks about that there are some documents. There's three sets of documents. There's weekly reports, there's OSIP reports, and there's daily timesheets. And they're widely divergent for the same time periods. They're widely divergent for the same time periods.
So what's your position on your ability to investigate this type of a claim within 30 days?
Absolutely, Your Honor. If you look in the closing arguments made by my client's predecessor counsel, which I think excellently summed this up, there are times for same time periods where they've got one employee time report that says 400 hours on something, and they've got another report that for the same day, for the same time period, said 800 hours. They're so widely divergent. That was their problem, why they had to try to go with a total cost method for calculating damages, is because their own records were disproved any other theory of damages, so they had to take a wing and a prayer on that theory of damages. I strongly request, Your Honors, to take a look at the amounts paid. It's important to appreciate that that's why they weren't able to establish damages, because there was so much paid, you could not tell the difference. If there is a statute that needs to be enforced in this case, it's 108-2457, the waiver statute. If you can't get a waiver from your lower-tiered sub, give them the checks for the amount that's on the waiver and think you're done, then have them come forward with a supposed oral settlement agreement that doesn't exist anywhere in the documents and doesn't match up with any of the numbers.
And tell me again, what was the amount on the waiver form?
The amount on the waiver form was the
$440,000.
$546,000. Right. And it's also important to keep in mind, Your Honors, there was an additional $36,000 amount that reflected in a separate waiver that was delivered at the same time, and there was a check for that payment at the same time, and that was the basis for a separate mechanics lien on Tier 3 of the ARIA project, or the ARIA phase of City Center. That matter went before Judge Kadish in a separate proceeding, and she expunged that lien based upon the waiver. So we have an inconsistent result at the district court level based upon the same parties, the same operative facts. Waivers delivered at the same time with the same contents, just different amounts, and payments made at the same time and accepted. Lastly, I guess I'd like to point out, Your Honors, if there was a separate settlement agreement, an oral settlement agreement for the amount that ICS claims of $600,001, and it wasn't fully performed, that limits the amount of recoverable damages. We clearly paid $477,000 against the $600,000, and that was to settle Veer Towers and ARIA Tier 3. The most that leaves you with on the Veer Towers aspect in this case is $123,000. That's the maximum amount of their claim.
So am I incorrect that the district court found the parties agreed to $601,000 for an unconditional waiver? Is that a mistake on my part?
I believe that is a finding by Judge Gonzalez. Well, inherently, it would be a finding, and she was therefore concluding that there was a settlement agreement reached.
Okay. All right, counsel. This is a complicated little case, and we certainly appreciate your briefing. It was very well done. The argument was very helpful to us. We set this for argument because the facts are certainly not simple facts. And we appreciate your time. This case will stand submitted.